Welcome to the Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners. I am Sally Higginbottom, and today I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Louise Newson about the module she has recently written on the new NICE menopause guidelines. Hello, Louise.
Hello, Sally.
Do you have a particular interest in menopause management?
I do, actually. I've always been very interested in the menopause, and I've been sitting in my room for the last 15 years as a GP, loving treating menopausal women. And it's not until I've become older and perimenopausal and my friends have that I've realised that the management is very different in different practices. So when the NICE guidance came out a year ago, I was very excited, and it's made my interest more and more, actually. So now I do run a menopause clinic every week, which has been very interesting.
Excellent. And what do you find we most often misunderstand in primary care? What's the biggest mistake we make?
To be honest, the biggest mistake I think is, this is a very generalisation, but a lot of GPs are still giving antidepressants to women. And I think a lot of problem is that many people, GPs and women, do not recognise the symptoms of the menopause. So we all know about the hot flushes and night sweats, but what we do is we underestimate the loss of self-esteem, the anxiety symptoms, the depressive symptoms rather than proper clinical depression. We underestimate the even things like palpitations, urinary symptoms. And when you're busy in a 10-minute consultation, if someone comes with palpitations, you don't always think about the menopause. And if it's not thought about, you can't diagnose it and then you can't treat it.
Oh, that's very interesting. And the new NICE guidance came out last year. How was that received in the menopause community?
Well, really positively. I was at the British Menopause Society meeting not long after they came out, and it's been great because they were the first menopause guidance done by NICE. And I think it's been really good because people can then say, look, I'm doing this because NICE say, rather than in the past, I've always said, well, to my patients, look, I've read the evidence, I've written about it, I know that for the majority of women under the age of 60, HRT is safe. Whereas now we can say, look, NICE say this. And that makes it so much easier. So it's been very exciting. And a lot of menopause experts are very, very positive about the NICE guidance.
Oh, that's interesting. We are free to perhaps use HRT a bit more than we were
totally
before.
Yes.
Excellent. So let's start at the beginning. What's the definition of a menopause?
And this causes a lot of confusion. So a menopause, as I'm sure you know, is a retrospective diagnosis. So it really means you haven't had a period for 12 months. And after this time, clearly you're postmenopausal. But before this time is more important in some ways because these women are perimenopausal. And I'm sure we've all seen women in our surgeries that have a period and they maybe miss 3 or 4 months and think, oh, maybe I'm going through the menopause. And then their periods will start again and they'll say, oh, no, I'm not menopausal. So a lot of people won't come and see their doctor because they don't think they're menopausal, because they're perimenopausal. But clearly when we talk about menopausal symptoms, they're the same as perimenopausal symptoms. So this causes a lot of confusion with doctors as well, but especially with women.
I see. So that's helpful to think about the perimenopause perhaps as a time for treatment rather than waiting until women have finished their periods. And in terms of diagnosis for the menopause, do we need to do blood tests?
Well, yeah, this is great. So this is where NICE guidance is very important, I think, for GPs to just listen and read and think about how to diagnose the menopause. So they're very clear, really. So women over the age of 45 who have classic menopausal symptoms, we can just diagnose menopause or perimenopause if they're still having periods. So this means we don't have to do FSH levels. We certainly don't have to do estradiol or LH levels. We can just get on and treat these women. So that saves a consultation. It saves having to send them for a blood test. It saves the patient, but it also saves us our time. We can get on and treat them. Women who are younger, so in between the ages of 40 and 45, then it's really up to us. They suggest we can do FSH levels, but we don't have to. So if we know for sure there's nothing else that we think are causing their symptoms, we can get on and treat. But women under the age of 40, which is a very important area, these women with premature ovarian insufficiency, affects around 1 in 100 women in the UK, these women should have FSH levels, and they should be done at least twice, around about 6-8 weeks apart. So you should never diagnose or not, or say to someone they're not menopausal if they've got one normal FSH level and they're below the age of 40.
Okay, and we'll come back a bit to the premature ovarian insufficiency because it's quite an important area, as you say. So We mentioned the range of symptoms women might experience, and hot flushes are the typical and in some ways the easiest thing to identify. Mm-hmm. What else should we be thinking about in terms of symptoms?
So the average age of the menopause in the UK is 51. A lot of people start with symptoms at 45. So women in their late 40s who present with symptoms of anxiety and depression, we need to think about menopause. We need to ask them. We need to think about it. Also, I've had a lot of patients that come thinking they've got dementia. They've got a family history and they're worried because they can't remember things. They're putting the keys in the fridge. They come into a room, can't remember what they've gone in for. People with tiredness, people with brain fog, very vague symptoms. But when you piece them together, a lot of the time it's due to their low estrogen levels. The other thing is, I've already mentioned urinary symptoms, so increased urinary frequency. Women who come with urinary tract infections or symptoms of urinary tract infections. And the other thing that we don't often talk about is vaginal dryness. So this can cause dyspareunia, but it can also cause just irritation, discomfort. I've had people that have found it difficult to horse ride or to ride a bike, and they're not aware that that's related to their low estrogen levels. And then you can get other symptoms like itchy skin, dry skin, hair changes that are very soft signs, but unless you ask and think about them, people might not tell you.
Okay, so quite a range of body systems to think about. Now, a lot of the anxiety about prescribing HRT, as people will remember, came from the big studies that were done a few years ago now, including the WHI study. Mm. What's your take on the evidence?
Well, the evidence is very good, actually. And I think that one of the problems with the WHI study, which, as you know, came out over a decade ago, was it was leaked to the press too early, before they did a proper sub-analysis. So when it came out into the press one summer, it came out saying there's a massive increased risk of heart disease, there's an increased risk of stroke, there's an increased risk of breast cancer. So lots of people stopped taking HRT, unsurprisingly, at that time. But when they have actually looked at the data properly, there's some really important messages. One of them is that women who only take estrogen, so those women that have had a hysterectomy, those women do not seem to have an increased risk of breast cancer. And that's very important. The other thing is, it seems to be the type of progesterone that is associated with this increased risk of breast cancer. Also, when they look at the age difference, this is when it's really important. The older women, and WHI was set up to look at people who were average age 63, 64. They were starting HRT in these women to see if there were long-term benefits from HRT. So when they started older women, so women over the age of 60 on HRT, they seemed to be the ones that had increased risk of stroke and a higher risk of breast cancer. But the cardiovascular problems were more in the older ones. But when they look out at the younger women, so these are the women who are just your average menopausal women that we see day in, day out, when they started HRT, they had a lower risk of heart disease. So they're very different when you start HRT in older women to younger women. So that's why people now talk about this window of opportunity. And other studies have echoed this to show that when women are normal menopause age, so within 10 years of the menopause, you start them, you can have around a 50% risk reduction of cardiovascular disease. And that's very important. Also, there's a reduction in osteoporosis. But these figures haven't really been leaked to the press. The press haven't got hold of them. Yeah. The other thing is, there was a big study that came out from the British Journal of Cancer in the end of August this year, 2016. And as you may be aware, that was all leaked to the press, 3 times increased risk of breast cancer. So people that may be a bit more confident with HRT are now really not confident and very confused. But actually, when you look at that study and look at the data, it doesn't show us anything different that we didn't know. So it does show that the worst types of HRT, some types of progestogens, for taken for a long period of time, more than 15 years, then there is an increased risk, around 3.3 increased risk. But if this is a relative risk, not absolute risk. And when you compare it to drinking a couple of glasses of wine or being overweight, you're more at risk of breast cancer if you drink a couple of glasses of wine or overweight than you are taking the worst type of HRT for 15 years. So that puts it into perspective, I think, for us and also for women.
That's very helpful, and that's a good way of putting it. And what do you find in terms of hot flushes? People have used a variety of things other than HRT over the years. Do you have any thoughts about use of SSRIs? What does the guidance say about using
non-HRT? Yeah, the guidance say there's no doubt that HRT is the best treatment for vasomotor symptoms, so that's your hot flushes and night sweats, because it's treating the underlying cause of estrogen deficiency. But obviously there are some women that can't, for medical reasons, take HRT, or those that don't want to. So SSRIs can work. They often actually only work short term. They don't always work in the long term, but for some people it's definitely worth trying. It is worth noting, obviously, that they can reduce libido, and a lot of menopausal and perimenopausal women have reduced libido anyway, so that's a double whammy. So it's worth advising women. And there's lots of herbal preparations, but NICE are quite clear not recommending them because there isn't good evidence that they work, but that doesn't mean without the evidence that they don't work, but they don't really recommend them because they have been associated with, some have been associated with liver failure, for example. You don't always know what you're taking, and they do say that they should have a THR logo, which is a logo to say that it's a regulated herbal product. But even then, you still don't know the effects that they're having. And I think for me as a GP, I'm very interested in the cardiovascular risk reduction and osteoporosis risk reduction with these hormones in HRT. So I'm very clear with my patients that although maybe a herbal preparation or an alternative preparation may indeed help their hot flushes, acupuncture has been shown recently to help, but placebo helps as well, we know, these products aren't going to help reduce their risk of heart disease or osteoporosis, which, as you know, increase a lot as we get older.
Absolutely. So they're there, but they're not particularly advised.
Certainly not first line.
No. And can you just run us through the different types of HRT we might use for different sorts of patients?
So just to keep it very simple, if you don't have a womb, a woman without a womb only needs estrogen. And estrogen is available as a tablet or as a patch or as a gel. Now, the main difference between this is, personal patient preference. Obviously, some people just like taking pills. But when estrogen is taken as a pill, then it can increase your risk of clot, only by a small amount because it activates your liver clotting factors. So if it's taken as a gel or a patch transdermally, there isn't an increased risk of clot. If these women have got a womb, then there's two different ways to take it. You've got the cyclical HRT, where they still have a period, and this is usually given to people if they're still having periods. So this is your perimenopausal women, then that should be continued for around a year, and then they change to a continuous combined, and giving the progesterone continually means that they don't have periods. Now, if you starting a postmenopausal woman, so a woman that hasn't had periods for at least a year, you don't need to start cyclically. You just start on the continuous combined HRT and carry it thereafter, because probably the one advantage of the menopause is not having periods. So it's important to tell women, and even the women who are younger, I always say to them, look, after a while, I'm going to change so you won't need to have your periods, because they don't want to have periods.
No. And my personal favourite option for prescribing HRT is to use a Mirena coil as the progesterone arm. Do NICE have anything to say about that option?
Not really. I mean, it's a good option for some women, and certainly the younger women that need contraception, it's great, because obviously HRT isn't a contraception, and we need to be clear to our patients about that. Interestingly, the recent study in the British Journal of Cancer I mentioned didn't talk about Mirena coil. It also didn't mention Nutrogestan, which is a micronized progesterone, which is the so-called body identical progesterone that is the same molecular structure as the progesterone we produce ourselves. And that is thought to be more breast neutral, if you like, compared to some of the older types of progesterone.
Okay, so something for the future, perhaps. So in practice, when and how do you stop HRT?
Well, I think like anything that we do in practice, it's an individualised choice. And NICE are very clear about the way that we use HRT and talk to women, that it has to be an individual decision. And that's the same with stopping HRT. So some women just take HRT to get through their menopausal or perimenopausal symptoms. So after 3-5 years, a lot of women can have their HRT reduced and they have no symptoms. And they've almost come out the other side. They're postmenopausal, and that's fine. But around, we know sort of 10, 15, maybe 20% of women have symptoms of the menopause for more than a decade. So when these women stop or reduce their HRT after a few years, they get their symptoms. And a lot of people think that HRT is delaying their menopause. But these symptoms that have been unmasked by reducing their HRT are because these are the symptoms they would be getting anyway. So then a lot of these women then decide to go back on their HRT. And then they might try again a few years later to reduce or stop. The other side, I have patients in their 70s, even 80s, taking HRT. And the beauty of HRT is that it's not a one dose fits all. So we often give them lower doses as they get older. But people enjoy the benefits. They enjoy feeling better, obviously. They enjoy the cognitive improvement, but they also know that they've got something that's helping their bones. And so it's a personal choice. And I think it's all about discussing the risks and benefits. Certainly up to the age of 60, NICE are very clear that the benefits usually outweigh the risks. So it's more after 60, we have to be clear to our patients that there may be more risks.
Okay, that's really helpful. The module mentions topical estrogens for vaginal atrophy. Mm. What's your experience of prescribing those? I know my experience of prescribing them is enormously positive.
They are phenomenal. I have so many patients who are elderly, they're not sexually active, but they are floored by symptoms of genitourinary insufficiency, so or atrophic vaginitis, for want of a better word. People that come in with the current UTIs, they're just uncomfortable, and you treat them and it's amazing. And I think what NICE are very good, because they state that topical estrogen, so if vaginal estrogen, can be used safely in the long term. So that means we can put them on repeat prescriptions. And in the past, people used to give 3 months. These people then feel a lot better, and then you'd say, oh no, you've got to have a drug holiday, you can't have them. And these poor women, these symptoms would return. And we know that postmenopausally, atrophic vaginitis gets worse. Other symptoms of the menopause, you can come out the other side and feel better. But around 70-80% of women who are postmenopausal have atrophic vaginitis, and they don't talk about it. They just think it's an aging process. But topical estrogens are safe. There's very few contraindications. The main ones is if someone's got active breast cancer, so breast cancer where they're receiving treatment. So even people who have had a history of breast cancer can still use topical estrogens. And also those people that have got undiagnosed vaginal bleeding, which makes sense. You need to investigate those people. Also, when they have long-term vaginal estrogen, they don't need to have any progestogens as well. And it's a low dose that's given, and so very little is absorbed. And when you look at the figures of how much is absorbed, it's usually only in the first day or two. And then once you get an increase in the epithelial lining, then less gets absorbed, and it's the same as placebo. So they can be given as creams or the tablet, the Vagifem, but also there's an S-ring, this a vaginal ring that I use a lot for my elderly patients, and that lasts for 3 months. So that just needs changing 4 times a year.
Excellent. And just as we finish, we mentioned right at the start women with premature ovarian insufficiency. So these are women who are having, as is sometimes called, an early menopause. Do we need to do something different with these women?
Yeah, we need to diagnose them. 1 in 100 women under the age of 40 have premature ovarian insufficiency. And most people have still not heard of it. I've come across ladies who have been told by their GPs, oh, you're too young to have the menopause. No, we're not going to test you. And that's terrible, because we know these women who don't have estrogen in their bodies, who are in their 30s, 20s, they have a really high risk of cardiovascular disease and osteoporosis, and also dementia in the future. So they have to be treated with estrogen, either in the form of HRT or combined contraceptive pill, because they are lacking estrogen. So it's a bit like treating someone who's hypothyroid. You're just replacing the hormones. But we have to have a low index of suspicion in women that have amenorrhea, because some of these people, around 20%, don't have symptoms of menopause. So they might just be a bit tired. They might not have symptoms, or they might not realise they have symptoms until you start treating them. So we really have to be thinking about doing FSH levels in these young women. And like I said, there should be at least 2 FSH levels around 8 weeks apart.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much for going through all that with us.
That's fine. It's been lovely.
And thank you for listening to this Essential Knowledge Update podcast from the Royal College of GPs.